Every day, companies you've never heard of are making millions off your personal data. Your name, address, phone number, even details about your family are pulled from public records on the internet, then sold without your consent. There's an entire marketplace built on your privacy, and most people have no idea it exists. Aura fights back. Aura removes your personal data from broker sites and keeps it off. Aura also alerts you fast if your information shows up in a breach or on the dark web. But Aura is more than just a data broker removal system. It's a full digital security suite that protects every part of your online life. Aura gives you a VPN to stay private, antivirus to block threats, a password manager for safer logins, and spam call protection to shut down scammers. Aura scans the dark web for your most sensitive information and notifies you instantly if anything is exposed. And if your identity is ever stolen, you're backed by up to $5 billion in insurance and 24/7 US-based fraud support. Other service charges about the same, but only cover one or two areas. Aura gives you everything: data broker removal, identity and credit monitoring, device protection, and fraud support, all in one simple app. Aura removes what's already exposed, protects what's not, and puts you back in control. Go to aura.com/remove for complete digital protection and peace of mind. That's aura.com/remove.
Let me tell you about the online cannabis company that's changing the game. Mood.com. They created an entirely line of functional gummies, 100% federally legal THC blends, discreetly delivered right to your doorstep. And here's the best part. You can get 20% off your first order at Mood.com with the promo code Ravens. Now, I've tried a bunch of their gummies myself. Each one's totally unique. The Sleepy Time gummies knock me out right away. They help me unwind fast, leave me refreshed the next morning. The Epic Euphoria gummies, they're perfect for when your day just isn't going the way you want it to go. What makes Mood special is how they pair the THC with natural herbs and adaptogens. You won't find blends like this at any local shop. They've got gummies designed for focus, relaxation, clarity, even energy, all made from cannabis grown on small, family-owned American farms. No pesticides, no shortcuts, just high-quality weed you can trust. Plus, Mood backs everything with a 100-day satisfaction guarantee. So head on over to Mood.com, check out their amazing selection, and don't forget to use the promo code Ravens at checkout to save 20% off your first order.
Attention BetMGM customers. Have a friend who loves sports as much as you do? Here's a chance for both of you to earn a $50 bonus when they sign up through BetMGM's Refer a Friend program. Just sign into your BetMGM account and click on the Refer a Friend program to send your friend a message inviting them to register a new account in the same state you use BetMGM in. Once your friend signs up and makes a deposit, they'll receive a $50 bonus. And once your friend places a bet with their bonus and the wager is settled, you'll receive a $50 bonus as well. Share the excitement and get a $50 bonus every time you refer a friend to BetMGM. Visit BetMGM.com for terms and conditions. Must be 21 years of age or older to wager. Ohio only. New and existing customer offer. All promotions are subject to qualification and eligibility requirements. Rewards issued as non-withdrawable bonus bets. Bonus bets expire in 30 days. Please gamble responsibly. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Winning comes in all shapes and sizes. Every day there's an opportunity for a win, just like scratchers from the Virginia Lottery. Every day grab and go, every day giftable, every day fun. It's where anticipation meets instant gratification. And they're satisfying to scratch, no matter the outcome. Like the new Virginia Lottery Scratcher Colossal Cash. It's loaded with $100 to $500 prizes. Now, that's an everyday win. Drive to the nearest Virginia Lottery retail location and pick up a scratcher today. Odds of winning any prize, 1 in 3.21.
Introducing the Lowe's List for Innovation. While our aisles are filled with innovative products, we've selected our favorites just for you. Like the exclusive Whirlpool washer with industry-first 2-in-1 removable agitator. We love this washer because you can customize any load. And with other smart features to streamline your laundry routine, this product is a must-have for families. Shop the full Lowe's List of top picks at Lowe's.com. Lowe's, home to any budget, home to any possibility. U.S. only.
All right, it's film study again. If you've forgotten, the Ravens just won a couple days ago, 26-14, victory over the Steelers on Sunday Night Football. Episode previous to this, we broke down the defense. Today, we're going to break down the offense. Ken McCusick, how you doing?
Life's good, Josh. Still riding that cool wave from that Pittsburgh win on Sunday night.
That's way better than riding a getting over a Pittsburgh loss or a Ravens loss to the Pittsburgh. Those are tough weeks.
I was dreading it. I don't really want to totally harp on this, but I will say the process of doing the evaluations we do is quite time consuming. And when we go into the night, there can be some conflict over people wanting to go to sleep in the household and others needing to keep scoring so they can write in the morning. That sort of thing can happen. So it's real nice to do it after a win. There's a lot less friction and tension, and we finish the job on time and everybody's happy.
Yeah, I think during the off season we kind of broke down one episode on how you do your process. We'll have to get to a little bit of that another time because I feel sorry for everything that you do, because even on a win, because you watch these games like 8 times.
After, no, it's a labor of love.
Yeah. I know you love it. I could not I would not be able to do it on a tough loss. I'm glad that you love doing it. You have taught me a lot about the game because you know what you're doing and you watch these games over and over and over again. Not only me, but I know our listeners appreciate it as well, and all the writer, everyone over at Russell Street as well. So today we're going to talk about the offense, and Joe Flacco immediately after the game when they went up and said, "Hey, you beat the Steelers, isn't this exciting? How do you feel about this?" And his response was, "Well, I'm disappointed in myself. We should have put up more points. We left points on the field."
They did. They left some points on the field. There's no doubt about it. And some of it is fair self-disappointment. But it's easy to see the Ravens scoring 40 in this game. 40-14 would not have been an unreasonable outcome. In the first half alone, you had a very easy overthrow to Crabtree where he was open by about 6 or 7 yards, would have had a clear run down the sideline. I think it's unlikely he would have been caught, but it certainly would have been a gain of at least 40 or 50 yards on the play. The fact that Alex Collins fumbled at the 1 yard line also cost the team plenty. So, there were points left on the board. It was a thorough drubbing of the Steelers. I don't think there's any Steelers fans out there saying, "Well, if this has gone our way and this has gone our way, then we could have won this game. And if the refs screwed us," and I just don't believe there's anybody out there saying it. It was a pretty clear domination.
Yeah, and. Yes, the Ravens dominated a lot more than the score showed. To come out and score 14 points within the first 5 minutes of the game clock it immediately felt like different than previous Steeler games, that this wasn't going to be a 3-point victory.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen him lead by 14 at Heinz Field and go down in the playoffs. So that's
doesn't
feel either.
I was never comfortable.
Yeah, right. But I do want to say that NBC's entire storyline of the game was ruined in about the first 5 minutes with Tony Jefferson's strip of Vance McDonald and the 14-0 game, 14-0 score. The combination of those two things had screwed up a lot of their prep work, that's for sure.
I know you like to point out that their storyline was broken with the strip. They did not get off script. They kept on plowing through and pretended that strip did not happen. And I still think that was an interception, not a fumble.
Yeah, I go with that. I think an interception is fine, but they gave Vance McDonald a reception. He caught all 5 balls that were thrown to him in the game and just fumbled that one.
All right, well, if you have him in a PPR league, you are at least happy for that, even though you then lost 3 points after the fumble. So,
okay.
I guess you weren't happy at that point. All right, let's get into this. Let's start with ample time and space, because a tweet came in from Jamie who says, "Hey, Ken, what are the parameters for ample time and space? I did a quick search but couldn't find anything." And can't find it because this is your own formula. We've talked about it a few times. We gotta make sure we bring it up every couple of weeks because there's always new listeners. So let's get into ample time and space.
Yeah, I want this to come up during a season about as often as I want to see a roughing the passer flag. So maybe 3 times during the season is fine, but we don't have to go over it more than that.
Unless we're celebrating it.
Yeah, a lot of the listeners know it, but ample time and space is essentially a 3-second pocket where the quarterback has room to step into his throw. That's the important component, in a 60-degree arc to either side, 60 degrees to either side of the intended receiver. So his feet aren't obstructed and he's not feeling constrained in the pocket in that way. And the 3 seconds, often a quarterback will have the ball out before 3 seconds. People ask what happens under those circumstances. Well, then I have to actually take a look at how the blocking is set up and make a decision as to whether or not I think the pocket would have held up for that period of time. I would say usually it's fairly obvious, but when it's not obvious what would have happened, it's not an ample time and space situation. It's instead marked as ball out quick, which is a subset of the not ample time and situations where the quarterback may be bailing out the offensive line for getting rid of the ball quickly. So that's kind of the two definitions. It's the ample time and space definition going with the ball out quick definition that together provide a picture of how much opportunity that quarterback had.
Right. Now, ample time and space is your formula, right?
That's right. It's of my own design.
You're not going to see this at PFF or anything else.
No. PFF actually has a less strict definition of pressure. So both on the defensive side of the ball and the offensive side of the ball, I'll show more pressures. So the offensive lineman will give up more pressures in my system, and there'll be a few more pass rush events. And defensive linemen and defensive pass rushers will garner a few more pressures by invading the integrity of the pocket.
Oh, well, Ken, we got to take this ample time and space, trademark it, license it, before all these big guys figure out what you're doing and how you're coming up with this formula.
All right, fun times.
All right. So now that we laid it out, let's talk about how Flacco did with this.
Sure, okay. So in this game, Flacco, it seemed like he had all day to throw, and he did have a good amount of time, or a reasonable amount of time, but it's only 19 out of 44 ample time and space opportunities, which is 43%. A lot of the other times, though, he was getting the ball out quickly. So a lot of those, you know, we saw a lot of slants to Snead, some quick passes there. We saw other quick passes all over the field. We saw some design plays where the ball went out once on, I think, on a middle screen. So we had a variety of different play calls that really weren't designed necessarily to even be set up for ATS, but yet the ball was out quickly enough and some good yardage accrued from it. Now, when I split out those opportunity sets, I see that Flacco, with ample time and space, let me get to my little chart here, completed 16 of 19 throws for 250 yards, 2 TDs, and 0 interceptions. That is 13.2 yards per pass, and is one of the best figures he's ever had in the 9 years I've been collecting data on this. So the average over that period has been 8.1 yards per play with ample time and space, and 13.2 is really exceptional. Individual games, they really very rarely gotten higher. I think I remember a 15 back a few years ago, but this was in the top five ever that he's recorded. Without ample time and space, he was 12 of 23 for 103 yards, was sacked twice for 8 yards, 3.8 yards per play, and that's just a hair below average. Average for without ample time and space is 4.2 yards for the previous 8 years. So that gives you an idea. Overall, 86 yards better than in his opportunity set. So we look at that and we say, okay, the offensive line gave him this set of opportunities. Did he make good on that set of opportunities? Well, he did, and he did 86 yards better in this game. A lot of that was success on the deep ball in this game. In particular, he throws to John Brown were good, and he had some decent yards after the catch from Max Williams in this game. So positive things generally happening around the field, and this was one of the really good ones. The other thing about it was conditions were very nice at Heinz Field. So you have a nice warm weather game with no precipitation. That's perfect for passing the football. And it was kind of an ideal opportunity for the Ravens to flex their speed against a really questionable Pittsburgh secondary.
Right. It was nice to go to Pittsburgh and it not be December, November. And yeah, not the cold, snow, rainy.
I think they probably like that. I think, you know, I'm pretty sure the Ravens don't like playing every year primetime at Pittsburgh. In fact, the reason I think that is they once in the Harbaugh years asked for that not to happen again this year. And apparently they got their way the one time. And they've played some primetime games in Baltimore in the Pittsburgh rivalry, but they played fewer. And it just does seem like they would – avoiding primetime games in Pittsburgh is a good thing. And if you ask for no primetime game in Pittsburgh, that means you get no Thursday night game in Pittsburgh. So if they'll actually listen to you.
Well, and, they They don't do division games on Thursdays anyway, do they?
Oh, yeah. It was Cincinnati earlier this year.
Okay, that, you're right. You're right. I'm wrong.
It's the biggest hose job imaginable, Joshua. I do an article every year on the schedule, and having a Thursday road game is the worst single thing that can happen, except for a division Thursday road game, which is even worse.
Right, right. And that's why, for some reason, I was thinking they had restrictions on Thursdays. I think they did early, and then when they expanded to full season Thursdays,
well,
they got rid of it.
They have a way that they could do that. It doesn't take a set theory genius to figure this out. But since you play the same rotational schedule of divisional opponents or NFC opponents, and you could use either, but you could use a mix of the two by doing it across divisions. You could make it all intra-conference games, inside the conference games, where you play, you know, the same division. So for instance, this year the Ravens play the AFC West. The entire AFC North plays the AFC West. If you had all the AFC North games were Thursday night against the AFC West, then you'd avoid this divisional crap where you're giving huge advantages away. And then you could have all the AFC East games, whoever they're playing in the NFC, they would have those divisional games be the one. So two divisions could play the opposite conference, and two divisions could play the opposite division within the conference. So you could get a nice mix of conference and non-conference games, opponents who don't see each other. It'd be a great way to do it, and it would avoid this absolutely unfair bullshit with these Thursday night divisional games, which are just a huge schedule buster.
Yeah, of course. And I'm not a fan of Thursday games. I don't think many people are, except for the people who are making money off of the Thursday night games.
It's part of the league. It's not going away. We just need to figure out how to minimize the competitive impact and the impact on the playoffs.
Right. Now, Joe was able to get all this ample time and space and have all this time with the run game not really working too much.
Yeah, I mean, they didn't do too much with the run. They ran 30 times for 96 yards. Some of that in the second half was at times where the Steelers knew the run was coming, so it was going to be less effective. One of the real big runs of the game I remember was on that final drive where they, on the very first play of it, Buck Allen ran for 11 yards, and Skura pushed him upfield for what it seemed like about the last four or five of that. So, you know, I love it when you can just jam a running drive down the opponent's throat, whether they like it or not, at the end of a game. And that was part of what tells you a game is really one-sided, is when a team can do that.
All right. I'm going to sneak another tweet in here early because we got a bunch of tweets this week. We'll get to the mailbag, of course. But I want to get this one in because I want to talk about the schemes of the offensive line. And Sarah,
let me go back for one more second here, because I don't want to get off ATS for until we talk about this, because this is a big deal. Alex Collins obviously was not happy with that fumble.
Yes.
And you know, there's been commentary online that Alex Collins might be losing his job. I mean, there's nobody to take the job from Alex Collins. You know, they're not going to trade for Le'Veon Bell. In fact, there's now talk that Le'Veon is going to report in Pittsburgh for Week 7. There is no alternative, and he is the best alternative. But one of the things that is really – he is just lighting it up now these last few weeks is with his pass blocking. He had a beautiful low block in this game, and he had must have been two or three rib-busting chip blocks. So chip block is when Hurst usually or perhaps Stanley on their side has a guy teed up and usually centered – and the running back it gives him a jarring hit from the side and knocks the wind out of a pass rusher. And Collins throws him like nobody. He really throws his whole body into it, and you can tell he is loving it. I mean, some guys don't really like it because the increased chance of injury, or they just want to use their hands to kind of set the guy up more for the tackle. Collins is trying to inflict pain on that pass rusher when he does it, and I really love it. He is a lot of fun to watch when I'm looking at the offensive line.
That's great. That's good to hear. Collins, after that fumble, it seemed like he got the doghouse treatment for a while, and then they eventually brought him back. I don't think he came back till the third quarter.
Yeah, he was out for a while, and then one of the things you'll notice is that obviously they're still concerned about his fumbling because they had Buck Allen in the game on the final drive for all four of those snaps, and on the previous drive, I think they had him in some too. So basically what that's saying is we're not going to lose this game with a fumble at this point. So, Alex, you're not going to be in there.
Right, and that was a knock against Alex in Seattle too.
It was, and you know, the goods come as is. in this game. Right. You know, there are conditional draft picks that can apply to this, but Collins, when you have a waiver wire pickup, the goods come as is, and you take the good with the bad. You hope you can fix it. Collins immediately showed he was a very dangerous breakaway runner, and that's why he kept getting chances last year, despite a couple of early fumbles. Yes. You know, he had one game of 9 for 82, and you know he was getting tons of yards per run, and he'll keep his job, and honestly he'll be fine. Looks honestly like he's good also as a receiver here, and you know he had the receiving touchdown in this game on a nice play where they got it blocked up nicely and perhaps illegally, but he had a good game as a receiver, and I think he brings you more in the passing game now with his combination of pass blocking and receiving we've seen the last couple of weeks.
Right. Is the fumbles the reason that Alex Collins is not your goal line running back? Whenever they get up in there close, they switch to a lot of Buck Allen.
Well, I mean, obviously you had the fumble the goal line this game, but yeah, Buck Allen, I think there's other reasons why you do it that way. McGahee was a taller back, and they like to run that stretch play where the Ravens really had seven heavies in the game, including Haloti Ngata. And that was their bread and butter for a couple seasons in there. McGahee scored a ton of touchdowns. And it was one of the things you got with McGahee in there was a back with good vision and good decisiveness. So they were able to take advantage of that. Collins is a little bit shorter, and I think you probably gained something additional with Allen in the game at that point. Allen's also proven to be a pretty good back as a fullback to try and get you a yard, and also just in general when you need 2 yards, Allen is a pretty good guy. When you need 8 yards, Allen is probably not your guy because there's been a lot of he's a very low yards per touch guy. So,
right. All right, let's get into the scheme, and let's go with Sarah's tweet now, which says, it seems like both the offense and the defense both played some unusual formations.
Yeah, so we can talk about some of the basic stuff, but Sarah's right on track with this, because they had, first of all, they played more fullback, more heavy sets than they played in recent weeks. So they had 15 plays with 2 backs. Some of that, of course, was just using Buck Allen as a fullback, but the 11 with Ricard, so they're going heavy a little bit more. That's not unusual. I just include that. They had 7 empty sets. They weren't tremendously successful with empty sets because they're all going to be passing, but they had 7 for 41 on the empty sets, and that's a little something. It's a decent amount. I meant to do this, but I didn't go back and look at how many of those were third down conversions with empty. But that's a lot for the Ravens to run empty in a game that they're winning. In a game they're trailing, they'd run empty even more. But in a game they're winning, you wouldn't think that they do it very often. They had 5 unbalanced plays in this game, and there were 2 extra special ones. So we'll talk a little bit about that. They went unbalanced right once with Ronnie Stanley standing, split right and ineligible. Now we saw this in the last game with Alex Lewis. He was split off to the left side, ineligible, and just by waving his hands, he was able to get Von Miller not to rush the passer. So he froze him. Ronnie in this case stood split right, and obviously the Steelers had been on the film. And TJ Watt kind of pretended like he was going to fall for it, then he just went ahead and rushed the passer, and Ronnie Stanley was just out there twiddling his thumbs. And he actually moved past the line of scrimmage, which he shouldn't do. How he can help the team is he should move backwards behind Flacco to threaten, behind the line at which Flacco is, to threaten the receipt of a backward lateral. That's how he could actually draw a defender away. But he didn't do it in this case, and the Steelers weren't buying it. They obviously had done their homework on the plays the week before. But that play, in the end, went for a 2-yard sack, so Flacco didn't really have to get sacked in the play. Skura had given up a little front side pressure in the middle, but Flacco eventually just walked right up into the sack rather than throw the ball away, which I thought was kind of silly. So bad play for him in that particular case, but also a pressure allowed by Skura.
Sure. And that's some things. That's a place where we can see Joe grow. He had a mistake in the fourth quarter like that where he could have just went down with the ball and let the clock continue, but he threw it away and stopped the clock.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, there's times when it's good to take a sack like what you're mentioning there, and there's times when it's good to throw the ball away, and those are two things where he did the wrong thing. Now, let's remind ourselves, Joe Flacco is very good at this. I mean, he doesn't take a lot of unnecessary sacks. He takes the necessary ones. He generally knows how to throw the ball away, although he's not always out of the pocket to do it. Lamar Jackson is the guy who runs into sacks just at will. And he always tries to make a play and yes. always thinks he can, but his speed at this level is not as extraordinary relative to the other players on defense there, and that often can get him into trouble. So we already saw that a lot in the preseason and in the game against Buffalo when he had some extended playing time that he was very sack willing.
Yeah, and I, you know what, and I don't think it's a speed issue with Lamar. I think it's a head and eyes issue. Of catching up with the speed of the game, because he's seeing holes and he's seeing them still at the college level where the guys close those holes a whole lot quicker now at the NFL level. So I'm not concerned. I think he'll get there.
Right. He needs to, the other head issue with that is he needs to keep his head down the field. He needs to keep his eyes, looking for that open receiver. So even when he does step up, there's still an option to throw the ball there. He hasn't just tucked and committed to the run at that point.
Right. It is interesting to watch that. I like that he gets this year behind Joe, where we're seeing all the other rookie quarterbacks have to start this year in the NFL, everyone that was drafted along with him.
Mm-hmm. So we were talking some formation stuff, but let's jump off the Lamar Jackson for a thing. Is there anything in the mailbag about this, by the way, or is this a...
No, there's nothing in the mailbag. Lamar Jackson came up last night on Section 336, so I wanted to make sure we got to this today, because the Ravens did make a change in... using him on third down, where we saw a lot of first down, maybe a second down before. This time they pulled him in some third down, and even I think there was even like a third and goal that they pulled him in on.
Yeah, really good point. And there was a big play early in the game where there was a timeout called by Pittsburgh on third. I think it was a third and one play on the second drive.
Last second timeout.
Yeah, last second timeout. But the Ravens did two things on that play. They did insert Lamar Jackson, which was pretty cool, but they also inserted Orlando Brown at right tackle for James Hurst. Now, that is a pretty big red flag that you want to use Orlando Brown somehow as a run blocker to try and make space for Lamar. And in point of fact, they started to run that play, and you don't know how much the Steelers already knew they'd call timeout or whatever, or were reacting to the whistle faster. But Lamar broke into level two immediately on that right side and looked like he could run for a touchdown on the play. And I don't have a time reference for you right here, but anyway, I think most people who are watching the game know the play I'm talking about. And it was actually Orlando Brown on the field who helped seal block to the inside to create that space for Lamar. So impressive play. It's a good bit of trickery. And I think making a personnel change like that is probably always worth it, because I don't think Orlando Brown is that much worse of a pass blocker than James Hurst. And he if you put something in the head of the opponent, that's probably a good thing, regardless of what you're actually trying to do.
Yeah, and I think this was the first great... the Lamar Jackson plays haven't really gotten us much yet. But I think this is the first game where I could really watch it and say, yeah, the defense is a little shaken up whenever he goes on the field, because as soon as he comes out on the field, you see all the defenders pointing, you see the sideline yelling, and they're paying attention. They spent some time this week saying, hey, what if Lamar comes on the field?
Yeah, well, the thing we still have not seen on one of these insertions, he threw the ball, of course, some when he came in the game as a replacement for Joe, but when they're both on the field, we still haven't seen him throw the ball.
Right.
So that's when it's really going to get interesting, and you know, they did some when they had two quarterbacks. When they had Smith on the field occasionally with Flacco in 2008, they would have some throwback plays where Flacco would be by the sideline, and you know, nobody's really covering him. Somebody stays 5 yards opposite him, but Flacco would take a step back there, mm-hmm. accept the lateral, and then throw a long bomb. So I'm looking for that. I'm looking for him to just move out of the pocket, draw some defenders, and then get somebody open in level two or on two, have two options, one medium, one deep to throw to.
Right, and that brings me to what I don't like when these Lamar plays are called, is I don't like the Lamar behind center and Joe out as a wide receiver, because when Joe goes out as a wide receiver, he doesn't try. He stands perfectly still and doesn't even move. So then it feels like you're just taking a man off the field at that point.
Right, well, this is true of all players who you're going to sit out in that position. If you have an ineligible receiver over there, he absolutely needs to move behind the spot the quarterback is in if once the other team has keyed to the fact that he's not really a receiver. So you want to put your hands up initially for the football, that's fine. But as soon as that doesn't work out, retreat 5 yards and be ready to receive the ball there, because that's a position that should scare the hell out of the opponents.
Yeah, but
and should draw a
defender. But I don't think Joe even raises his hands. I think he just goes and stands over there and waits.
You're talking about what he does now, or what yes. you've seen him do, as opposed to what he could be coached to do.
Yeah.
So it's really a question of the Ravens need to change some of their offensive scheme to make Joe a threat as a secondary passer by having him be the yes. be get behind Jackson in terms of
or if the whole plan is to set people up with thinking that, just like me, that Joe's a wasted space and suddenly one week he's going to catch one and run, uh-huh. I'm all for that too. If that's what you're setting up, then show me the big play. And I think that's what everyone in Baltimore is waiting for, is we get excited when Lamar takes the field, but we're waiting for it to work. We're waiting for the big play.
Yeah, well, I go back to 2008 again, and Joe did catch a 45-yard ball that year against the Raiders. And he did it on a handoff. He did it on a handoff that was a reverse, and then he swung out. And frankly, it was too fast for the Raiders linebacker. Ravens linebacker, I think it was Beekert, was a little slow to recognize the play. But Joe was ahead of it, and, long bomb. If it had been thrown on target, it would have been a touchdown. As it was, Joe had to lay out for it, make the grab, and it was a beauty. But I would love to see Flacco's receiver again, too.
Yes. Yeah, he's a big guy. Get him downfield. Let's get into, speaking of big guys, let's get into Max Williams lining up and kind of hiding.
Okay, so we talked a little bit about this on the defensive episode, but this is where it really belongs. So we're going to just go over this briefly again. And I had an interaction on exchange on Twitter today that I thought some of the listeners might like to hear about if they didn't already read it. But Williams lined up at guard and was offset from the line of scrimmage. And I thought pretty clearly so. In fact, it's so obviously so that I thought if a guard had lined up in that spot, it would clearly have been a penalty. Well, I mentioned in the last show, as Gene Steratore had been the rules expert. It actually was Terry McCauley who was the rules expert that they had on the broadcast. So I tweeted to him and asked him, first of all, if a guard had set up in that position, would he have been flagged for it? And if so, doesn't that mean that Williams lining up in that position was necessarily legally formed and in a legal formation? So, and he said, no, he didn't think a guard would have been flagged for it, but he would have been warned. And then there was some sort of secondary comment about how if the tackle had been offset for him, which obviously wasn't part of the question I was asking, then he would have probably been flagged. But I don't believe him. I think that, a offset guard at that point wearing an ineligible number who had not reported would clearly have been flagged for that formation. I respect him, and I'm glad that he responded all the years of service he's had. But the other key thing that came out is he confirmed that they do have a meeting between the coaches and officials beforehand, and that they do talk. So the Ravens have an opportunity to explain the trick plays they have so they don't surprise the officials, which is an important thing to do. So it's not like the officials didn't know that was coming, and it's probably not like the officials didn't maybe give the Ravens some guidance on what to make sure they do to make sure they don't get flagged in that situation. So I think the Ravens probably met every standard that was expected of that officiating crew, whether Terry McCauley thought a guard would be flagged in that situation or not.
Yeah. And you blew my mind with the whole meeting with the officials. I had no clue that happened, and they went over plays until Monday night.
Yeah, apparently that happens all the way down in football to pretty low levels. And when I say that, at least down to the high school level of football. We were on vacation. We met a college coach once, and he was a Atlantic 10, A-10 referee. And he knew a lot about this, and there were all these situations. And I said, hey, you heard about the A-11? It's just a coincidence entirely, A-11 offense. And it's something a guy in New England designed for kind of a bad high school program, which ran every play on offense from a scrimmage kick formation. And the significance of that is, on scrimmage kick formations, you're not required to have five numbers in the 50s, 60s, and 70s that are ineligibles on the field. And so anybody on the play can be an eligible receiver, but there's other rules for scrimmage kick formations that you have to go by. And he'd never heard of it, but it was a very interesting conversation. And if anyone wants to look up that, Google A-11 offense and see what you find. Fascinating write-up on how that offense is designed. But one of the things they suggest is that you need to meet with the officials for a couple of two-hour sessions to get them to understand how the offense is run so they're not flagging you every play.
Right. And Yeah, that makes sense. And with the NFL changing rules all the time, you always want to talk to the officials because it seems like there's always a play every Sunday on some game that no one on the field knows what's going on and no one on the field knows the right calls, whether it's an official or the coach or something. There's always some confusion.
Right. And you don't want it to come up that the Belichick situation was very poorly handled a few years ago in the playoff loss at New England in 2014. We're still stinging from that in terms of how the officials handled the reporting of eligible receivers in that game. Because when you have a change in the reporting of an eligible receiver, there should be a opportunity for the defensive side to sub. And that was not observed in that game for whatever reason. I think the officials really choked on that one. But anyway, we're here now. We can, 4 years later, I guess we should be getting past that game.
Yes, yeah. Explain to me this Ronnie Stanley split right ineligible.
Okay, so that's the play I mentioned before he split right. The Steelers weren't buying it, and T.J. Watt just rushed the passer anyway. And the only thing, again, Ronnie Stanley should have done is move behind Flacco, so he is at least a danger to accept the lateral at that point. Instead, he wandered downfield a yard or two, and that didn't do anything.
Right.
It could have been a flag.
Okay,
actually.
So that's the point where you want him to go back. All right.
Yeah.
Anything else we missed as far as unusual formations this Sunday?
I think that's a lot of it. A lot of the rest of the stuff they did, they still got plenty under wraps. I feel like, just given the basic additional switches that we've seen from Morningweg, I feel like there's a lot of additional plays you could run off of those formations, including a lot of these double pass plays where we haven't seen that, including a lot of the pass backs to an ineligible receiver, and then that allowing you to have six eligible receivers down the field would be really cool. So they've got lots of things they could do, but we have not seen the whole playbook, and there's plenty for Marty still to pull out of his bag of tricks.
Right. It wasn't necessary in this game. Let's get to the offensive line scoring, and let's start with Ronnie Stanley since we were just mentioning him.
Okay, so Ronnie had a solid, I wouldn't say a spectacular game, and this is a question where PFF probably has him for less pressures than I did, but I have him for three pressures plus additional two half charges. He had a false start. Scores a .74 raw, B- after adjustment for having to face Bud Dupree. Bud Dupree has really matured into one of the better pass rushers in the league. He's near the top of the PFF pressure list for the year. So, he's a solid pass rusher and a good opponent for Stanley, and he did have some trouble with him. He had some trouble with largely getting bull rushed. Now, one of the things I've liked about Stanley, and if you're getting bull rushed, that's the least severe because it means you're not getting beat by speed. You're not getting forced into make holding calls by getting beat outside. Bull rush generally means you're keeping your position between the quarterback and the offensive and the defensive and the pass rusher. But you're still staying square to him even though you're losing ground. So the quarterback has a better chance to either move off the spot or get the ball out when that's all you're giving up. On the other hand, bull rushers tend to be pretty fast, and the fast ones obviously break down the pocket quickly, and they're not ideal either. But anyway, by and large, bull rushes are less severe negative consequences to them than speed rushes and some other spin moves and whatnot that can turn into sacks like that.
Gotcha. All right, Alex Lewis. What's going on with him? It seemed like he wasn't moving that well on the field.
Yeah, you got that right. I've been a fan of Alex Lewis and a proponent of Alex Lewis through these first four games, even if as his play has been stumbling a little bit. Now, he had 12 missed blocks in this game. That's an awful lot. In fact, I really would have to look back to see how many times that's ever occurred during the years I've been scoring this way, but I don't think it's many. And a lot of it, he just seemed to be stumbling around, I'm going to almost say like a zombie. He had eight pulls in this game. I scored him for making six. He had some very marginal ones among those six. So he's only got two of his misses came that way. But he missed a bunch in level two, a bunch of L2 NBs on my score sheet. Level two, no block. And that's not Alex Lewis I know. Alex Lewis that I remember from 2 years ago that I've even seen this year earlier, very decisive in level two, moves there, find block, make block. And he just didn't seem to be moving nearly as well in this game. I can't say exactly what the problem is, but he needs to not have a game like this occur again in those terms. Just very out of sorts looking on the field. He did allow a sack. That was a bad stunt exchange with Stanley. They had some difficulty in terms of making those work. I had some split pressures among them, but that sack I gave entirely to Lewis because it was really his inability to pick up the stunting player after he'd handed over his. So, you know, not a great game from Lewis. Had some negative pass blocking events. Didn't make all his run blocks. A D is the score after I make an adjustment for him. Frankly, I thought after we'd gone through the game, it was probably going to be an F. But in terms of actual pass rush events, he gave up 2 half pressures and the 1 sacks. And the Ravens had 72 plays. So when you run that many offensive plays, you expect obviously more negative events to occur. And the system eventually forgives him for a lot of his errors, or gradually forgives him for a lot of his errors.
All right. A quarter through the season, are we just marking Skura down as he's our center?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, he's playing really well. Had another pretty good game here. And, you know, centers don't give up that many pressures. I had him for 2 in this game. B score for the game, a B grade for the game. He didn't have any other negative events. He did have 6 missed blocks in the game that were aside from that. I like to look at missed blocks and categorize them 2 ways. Some missed blocks are not that serious, and moving to level 2 and not making a block is not that serious. Pulling and not making a block is usually not that serious. But when you get beaten and the ball is out quickly, that can be indicative of a bigger problem. And he had 3 of the 6, which I don't think is all that bad, honestly, where he was beaten at the line of scrimmage, once on a run play, twice on pass plays, that could have been could have turned into negative events but didn't.
All right. How about Marshall Yanda?
So Yanda, you know, always seems to have a good game. And this week, it looked like he was going to suffer from a holding call. I looked at the thing. It's fairly obvious that's Max Williams on the hold. I talked to the Ravens about it today, the Ravens PR staff, and they said that on Tuesday, the league looks at this thing with the Elias Sports Bureau, and they will probably correct it, or they may correct it. And in this case, Patrick Gleason said he'll ask the league about it again, or ask the league to look at it again if they do not correct this one. But anyway, you can kind of see Max Williams is getting a jersey grab in there. Yanda has his hand extended, but it's not anything close to a hold. And Yanda looked at the big board to see the replay of the play and threw his arms up. He couldn't see that he'd hold it, and he's right. He didn't hold on the play. And it was just last week, of course, against Denver that Yanda got flagged for a false start that was actually by James Hurst. So interesting that he's accumulating other players' penalties.
Right. That's what happens when you're a big guy. They just look over and they see you. Well, speaking of James Hurst, I didn't see much from him on the game, which is generally a good thing if you're an offensive line and I don't see you much.
Yeah, absolutely. If your number doesn't get called, that's a good thing. A lot of my comments about Stanley go for Hurst as well. Hurst is doing a good job, and some of it is the amount of chip blocking the Ravens are doing and a little bit of the help they're giving the offensive linemen, but they're finding ways to keep Hurst's man in front of him. And a lot of that is Hurst, but a lot of it is also some of the help he's getting. In this game, he allowed 3.5 pressures, as I have it scored. That's 3 fulls plus 1.5. So that was the only negative events he had. He did miss 8 blocks. Scores a C-plus on the game. Positive about what's occurring with here. You know, he's doing this against largely a 4-man pass rush for the Steelers. There will be more difficult times where he has to do some stunt exchanges and there's more going on with his responsibilities. As it stands right now at tackle, he's the beneficiary of, some people call them pop and slide. I call them the help blocks that come from Marshall Yanda, that where Yanda initially pins a man for Skura at center, usually a defensive tackle, and then he moves to the right to give whatever help he can to bail out James Hurst if he's giving ground in the pocket. So he's the beneficiary of that. He's the beneficiary of some of these Collins chip blocks that are, you know, breaking the edge rusher's ribs. And, you know, just it's not like he's not getting help, but it's also we got to give credit where credit's due. And I think that James Hurst has played at a higher level this year than I could have reasonably expected at right tackle. I'm not sure still that he's the best choice at right tackle, but he's performed well enough to not make it a terrible choice.
Gotcha. All right, let's get to the MVPs, where I explained it on the last episode, but I don't think I need to. It's MVPs. Everyone should know what this topic is. So let's go backwards, 3-1.
3-1.
Ken, who do you have as your number 3?
John Brown, my number 3. You know, pretty apparent game, 71-yard catch, target of some long balls. Flacco underthrew one of the long balls to him that could have been another big play. But a great game for John, and what he's brought in terms of a deep threat is a valuable part of the Ravens' offense.
I love that we have some wide receivers now. I wish Crabtree would catch the ball, but I like that we have wide receivers. My number three is Max Williams, and I'm giving him a little star this week just for that one trick play.
No, that's fair. Williams had some good yards after the catch otherwise and looked good. I'll give my number two. I'm gonna pull the Josh treatment and give it to the entire offensive line. It was a yeoman's effort. It wasn't an outstanding effort, but there wasn't really another single player. Yonda, of course, I could have given it to alone, but in general, the offensive line did quite well in this game. The one exception being Lewis, who had kind of another off week, but no complaints. And if they all play this well every game, this team is going to be fine.
And my number two is Justin Tucker. He's always solid, but especially in Pittsburgh, and he loves kicking there. And you can't say anything bad about him.
Yeah, great pick. No objection on that. My number one is Flacco. Huge game. Beat his expected yards by 86, I think, is the key metric for me in giving it to him as opposed to anyone else on the offense. And you know, the other guy, I guess, would be Brown that you could maybe put ahead of him. But to me, Flacco's plus 86 in the expected yards is the big metric coming out of this game.
All right, my last guy is James Urban. So I'm kind of going with you on the Flacco pick. So Joe's been through a lot of quarterback coaches, and we keep talking about what is different this year with Joe. Is it that he has wide receivers? Is it that he has health? And I want someone to look into this. Is it James Urban? And is this guy speaking to Joe differently than the past few quarterback coaches? Is there something? Because it seems like Joe's ball is coming out faster. Joe's moving around more. Joe's having fun again.
Right. I that's a good pick too. I heard James Urban in camp, and they had a nice schedule of interviews that day that were all basically related to Lamar Jackson.
Yes, because James Urban's history is with Michael Vick, so people say, "Oh, well, Lamar." Yeah, but what's he doing now?
Yeah, it is very well done. Obviously, he's got to be working with Flacco, and you know whether or not Flacco likes someone is clearly a good issue in terms of his play. I mean, he got into some squabbles clearly in the past with Cam Cameron, you know, where he would pronounce his name a different way that was right. Kind of almost derisively, you know, yeah, that's what I mean, Cam, kind of thing. You know, you'd hope you wouldn't have that kind of thing come up. I know he wants to run the show. I know he wants to be the guy, and you know, he'll get there in terms of his office, but he can't be above all forms of criticism. He can't be.
I feel like the last QB coach that he praised was Jim Zorn, and that's been a while. So, all right, let's get on to the mailbag. Getting your questions, use the hashtag FilmStudyMailbag on Twitter. That helps us to find them so we can answer them all each week. First one up is from Miggy Duran. Hi, Josh, big fan of the podcast from Mexico. When Jimmy is back, do you expect Carr to play some nickel? He did it sometime past seasons, and watching Tavon's problems versus big receivers like AJ, they could use some help there.
Okay, so I think that's a good point, and he's right that we saw a little bit of Carr in the nickel last year. Part of the reason they had Carr in the nickel last year was that Tavon was out. Now, what I'll say about Tavon is he is head and shoulders above the other nickel corners on this team. He's just a far better cornerback. In fact, you could make the case that Tavon really deserves an inside-outside role that's similar to Webb, but you can see the Ravens are almost playing no snaps where they don't have the nickel on the field this year. So now the second part is the big corner component to that, and would it be worth coming inside for that? Well, usually your slot guy is a change of direction guy, but when you do have a bigger lineup in there that may include a flex tight end, the guy the Ravens have been using in big nickel has been Chuck Clark. So they've been bringing a safety in to cover the slot on those plays. So I think either way, there's kind of a better option than Carr in the slot. So while I think, you know, it's good to find out where could you use a guy who played well, certainly against the Steelers, played very poorly against Denver, but came back and had a big game. I love the fact that the Ravens are actually going to have a difficult decision on how to allocate snaps with Jimmy Smith back. There's a good chance that Carr is going to end up losing some snaps. I don't think Humphrey should really lose many snaps at all. And Smith has to play somewhere. I don't think Tavon is going to be the guy to lose snaps because Tavon is too unique in terms of his change of direction skills in the slot and what he brings to you as a pass rusher there. Another thing I'll say about Carr is that Carr's durability is amazing. And one of the things I found when I looked at him before he came to the Ravens was he almost never participated in a run tackle unless it was absolutely necessary. So he was basically never second man to the ball. Tony Jefferson loved to be second man to the ball. Most cornerbacks are told in the NFL, stay away from the pile. We don't want you getting hurt on a stupid 4-yard run play, you know, where the difference is between, you know, 3 and 4 yards by you sticking your shoulder in there. It's not worth it to us. And he maintained his durability in the league by being very cognizant of avoiding contact. The point I was making with that is he's not an ideal candidate for Big Nickel, because Big Nickel, you want a run support guy, and he's not your guy for that.
All right.
Even though he's larger.
Gotcha. How do you expect, looking ahead, how do you expect the offense to look for the Browns compared to the Steelers? Do you anticipate this being a trap game? Will Marty keep up the unpredictable style? Will he try to throw some more Lamar? Will he save these for later in the year?
Okay, so Minion Hunter wants to ask the entire season's worth of questions. Yeah. We're going to go through these pretty quickly now.
Yeah, let's just focus just quickly on the Browns game with some of these questions.
Okay. So in terms of the Browns and Steelers, I am not concerned about the Ravens' specificity of game plan against the Browns. I think they will try hard to win this game. I think everybody realizes this is a critical divisional game. It is an opportunity for a divisional road win. That could be important as a tiebreaker versus the Bengals for certain, also versus the Browns. It's not a tiebreaker, but because the Browns already have a tie, so we can't really tie with them. But it could be a important decider in terms of the two-game flip in the standings. So critical game coming up, and the Ravens don't have a lot of opportunities on the schedule to get a road win. So this is one they need to try and convert. They're about a 3-point favorite, which means they're given about a 60-40 chance to win this game. You need to convert some of those tough win opportunities during a season. They just converted a 40% opportunity at Pittsburgh. That doesn't mean you give up on a 60% opportunity at Cleveland.
Right. And Cleveland's defense is not as concerned, and if the thing to be concerned about going to that game.
Cleveland's defense is no joke at all. They have a marvelous, one of the NFL's best pass rushers in Myles Garrett, and they have a cornerback who's looking fantastic so far this year that they drafted number 4 overall. So they really do have a very good defense. I'm much more concerned about their defense than I am the Steelers' defense. And I think if the Ravens did look at this game lightly and they don't really try and figure out how to neutralize Garrett, how to figure out how to give Joe time to throw and make things happen, just like they did against the Steelers, I think they run a big risk of losing this game. But that said, I don't think that'll happen. I think this team is riding high off its offensive creativity. This should continue for another week, and we'll see all kinds of plugs pulled in terms of what they'll do to the Browns.
All right. Josiah gets in with, what do you see as a problem with the running game? Is it the O-line? Is it formations, running backs, or all three?
Okay, so it's really hard for me to put my finger on one specific thing because I think it is a combination. They don't have a road grader in there. They're like a road grader without Jensen. So they have Yonda back, who was never really a true road grader. He's a great positional blocker and can open holes for you, but they've decided they want James Hurst in there over Orlando Brown. That would be the opportunity to get a bigger player in there who can really seal and who can really kick out. I think he gives you much more there. Their left-to-right power run guy is probably not quite as strong as Hurst was last year, although he's not bad. But the game I just saw, it wouldn't surprise me if this is a game where you move Hurst to left guard and you put in Orlando Brown for the first time at right tackle. And see what Hurst can do as a pulling guard. I don't think they'll do it, but if there was ever a reason after a particular game so far this year, this is the one where Lewis has looked the worst and honestly looks like he might have been playing hurt just from the way he was stumbling around on the field. So I wouldn't be thrilled with that move happening, but I think it is a possibility. And I think the notion of Lewis moving to center at some point during this year, I think we may be past the point where that's a consideration. I think Lewis, we haven't seen the anchoring problems from Skura that we expected we might see, and Lewis hasn't played well enough, dominantly enough at left guard to figure that he'd be the great anchor at center either. So, we're right now, Lewis is the one on the hot seat on the offensive line. That could change with time, but I think right now that's the situation.
All right, let's close out the mailbag looking ahead kind of at the year as a whole and Joe Flacco. Joe, Skyler gets in with Joe Flacco is on pace for 5,000 passing yards. Do you see him maintaining this or even throwing 4,500 yards?
No. The simple answer is no. So could he reduce his effectiveness slightly for the rest of the season and still come in with a very high number? Sure. If he did throw for 5,000 yards, it's probably going to be a case where it's not that they pulled out all the stops because they were winning. It's that they started passing a lot more because they were trailing in more games. It wouldn't be a good sign for the defense if Joe threw for 5,000 yards. This is one of the NFL's elite defenses. Yes. When you have that situation, like it or not, Joe Flacco is going to have less impressive passing statistics than just about any other quarterback in the league because he's going to be throwing safer passes. He's going to be throwing less. He's going to be throwing to convert first downs, but not necessarily to throw the deep ball. And he's almost never going to be throwing in the fourth quarter.
Right. It's game control.
It's game control.
All right. So, I missed one more question I want to get in before we get out of here from Marcus, who says, are the Ravens wasting Jordan Lacy by not having him active so far?
Yeah, that's a good point, Marcus. I don't know what they could do to get Lasley in the game. Right now, they're having trouble getting Chris Moore snaps. And he's the fourth wide receiver, looked fantastic, of course. Third-year guy who they're dependent on, in maybe leading a youth movement that might have to start next year. So you look at next year's wide receiver core, and they're going to need to find a new deep threat, or they're going to have to re-sign John Brown, which is going to cost a lot of money, I'm afraid. So one of those two is going to have to happen. So that may mean the number one pick goes to a wide receiver next year, or it may mean that Lasley has to step up and be that guy. I don't know if he really is. So anyway, they're going to need to figure out what they do to figure that out. But one way or another, the Ravens have to figure a way to get younger at wide receiver. They can't be on the free agent treadmill and be spending $20 million of their cap every year on the wide receiver position just because they're too inefficient at drafting and developing receivers. They have to figure out how to do it right, and they have to figure it out at the rookie level, not at the going out and getting a sixth or eighth or ninth year player to come in and play for the Ravens from free agency.
All right, great. This past week, our listeners have done a great job with going to iTunes and writing reviews for the podcast. So I want to encourage everyone to continue to do that, but I do want to address one review that was on there, which is a positive review. Everything that everyone's writing on there is 5 stars and great. And then they bash me a little bit as saying I'm not as smart as Ken. But that's fine. That's proper. That's true. But one person on there made a good point where he said his suggestion to improve the show would be that we need a way for people to send in mailbag questions without a Twitter account. So we're going to come up with a solution, and we'll have a solution by the next episode.
So just an email address would be fine for that, right?
An email address, or we'll put it up on one of these websites where you can do a little form, so you can even enter it anonymously if you want.
Okay.
So we'll have a solution by the next episode. So thank you for that suggestion. Feel free to send show suggestions along, just like you do mailbag questions.
And my email is out there. It's available to you on the RSR website. I'll let you go there and get it if you need to. Other contact information, by the way, I'm at Film Study Ravens on Twitter. Please follow me if you do have a Twitter account. If you go out to Russell Street Report, you'll see some more developed versions of these same things. If you like tabular data and really like nerding out over the individual stuff, you get a little more there. And the big thing you get from the articles there is quarter and time references that allow you to go through my film analysis the same way that I do and see if you see the same thing that I do or that I'm full of crap. We have the transparency for that. So anyway, Josh, let's talk a little bit about your show.
Well, we've got a little bit of business first. I want to let everyone know we've gotten some comments in about The podcast not working this past week on Google Play Podcast. I think that's what it is.
Okay.
And that's been fixed as of this evening. And there's been some issues with some of the embedded players on Russell Street not working in certain browsers. That was also fixed this evening.
Huh.
So I want to let your listeners know, thank you for that feedback. We were able to talk with our servers and get all that straightened out. And then I want to talk about our next episode, tomorrow's episode, where we're going to do a Browns preview like we've been doing, and we're going to get on Jeff Lloyd from the Locked On Browns podcast.
Okay, very prolific writer, and he does a lot of these crossover shows. He ought to be a very good guest. I'm looking forward to that one. I think all of these with the opponent analysts have gone very well. They're a sharp group, and I hope we've got another good one here, and looking forward to it.
Yeah, and
get your mailbag questions in for that way, by the way. If you have questions particularly about the Browns, anything they're doing,
yeah. Baker Mayfield.
We will exclude them if they're not tasteful questions. There's no reason for you to have a distasteful question for a Browns guest just because he's a from Cleveland or whatever.
Right. Leave those for me.
Yeah. We don't have anything that includes it. Who the hell still uses a payphone, if you understand that reference? we don't want to hear.
Right. All right, and then you can follow me on Twitter at Josh Soroka as well, and check out Birdland Sports, just like you're checking out Russell Street Report. Lots of good podcasts and content over on Birdland Sports.
All right, sounds great, Josh. Any new podcasts up there other than these?
Yeah, there's a new Section 336 that it came out on Monday night. Great episode. Some Orioles talk, some Ravens talk, and just a fun show. Not as analytical as this show. Way more commentary and arguing. But it's a good show. And then Dade's View, it has a new episode out. And Birdland BS has a new show that just came out this evening along with us. And I believe Neutral Zone Infraction will have a new show by tomorrow. I mean, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday is when we have about 6 different podcasts, maybe 7 episodes. Mm-hmm. All hit up on Birdland Sports to fill up your week.
Yeah, I don't know about you, but that's when I can't get enough of football, and every bit of discussion about the Ravens I want to see on those days.
Yeah, and it's perfect. It gets you plenty to listen to until Thursday night football, and then you're just fired up and ready for the weekend and ready for Ravens football again.
All right,
Kent. Well, we will talk soon.
Life's good, Josh.
At Lowe's, we're your go-to for great gardening values every day. That's why we've lowered our price on select bagged mulch, now starting at just $2.88 a bag. Mulch helps prevent weeds and retains moisture, and when you put it down around trees, shrubs, and flower beds, you'll see how beautiful it makes your outdoor space, just in time to welcome back family and friends. Shop online and pick up in-store. Lowe's, home to the best part of summer. Selection and product availability vary by location. While supplies last, U.S. only, excludes Alaska and Hawaii.
Winning comes in all shapes and sizes. Every day there's an opportunity for a win, just like scratchers from the Virginia Lottery. Every day grab and go, every day giftable, every day fun. It's where anticipation meets instant gratification, and they're satisfying to scratch no matter the outcome. Like the new Virginia Lottery Scratcher Colossal Cash. It's loaded with $100 to $500 prizes. Now that's an everyday win. Drive to the nearest Virginia Lottery retail location and pick up a scratcher today. Odds of winning any prize, 1 in 3.21.